Hello and welcome to the Eastern Centre for Innovation, Research and Learning podcast, where we speak to leading experts in education on important themes in teaching and learning. I'm John Beale, researcher in residence at Eton College, and today I'm joined by author and educator Ian Warwick. Ian Warwick is founder and CEO of London Gifted and Talented, also known as LG&T. Ian founded LG&T as part of the groundbreaking London Challenge, which has transformed education across London since 2003. LG&T have directly worked with over 4,000 schools and 11,000 teachers internationally, and more than 150,000 educators worldwide have used LG&T's award-winning high-challenge e-learning materials. Among Ian's books are Educating the More Able Student and World Class, both of which were published in 2016, and he co-authored two books for Routledge in 2018, Redefining More Able Education and Redefining English for the More Able. His most recent book, Learning with Leonardo, Unfinished Perfection, focuses on Leonardo da Vinci and explores strategies for improving creativity and innovation. Ian, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So after you taught in the comprehensive school sector for two decades, you founded London Gifted and Talented. Can you tell us what London Gifted and Talented is and what made you want to start it?
Sure. I mean, LG&T is basically an organisation that supports teachers to improve what they can do for more able and talented students. We publish guidelines, advice, we give hands-on support to school, we do observations, we rewrite curricula if necessary. We started in about 2004 as part of the kind of genuinely groundbreaking London Challenge. And as a result of that, we were reporting directly to the Prime Minister's policy unit. And over the course of the next 7 or 8 years, we've seen huge improvements across London, and that's to do with a huge amount of work being done by teachers across London, head teachers across London, and to some extent, to a small extent, to us in terms of the work that we put in. Why I started it was, it always intrigued me. I taught at a school that had 148 languages spoken Wow. in the school, and we had, I think it was 27 teachers whose sole responsibility was looking after the needs of students who had English as an additional language. There wasn't a single resource put towards more able students. Mm-hmm. It was as if, it was a very disadvantaged school, and it was as if in their heads some correlation had been made between disadvantage, English as an additional language, and the huge unlikelihood that you would have anyone highly talented mm-hmm. in that group of students. And I found that quite offensive for many reasons, and thought that actually for the disadvantaged students that we were teaching, unless they were given real support and resources that would support and help them to, for example, apply to top-end universities, they wouldn't be doing that for themselves. So I set up the Gifted and Talented, as it then was, scheme across the school, and then I set it up across two London boroughs, RBKC and Westminster, and then I was asked by the government to do it across all 33 London boroughs.
Wow. Okay, so how would you define a more able student?
I think in my research, I've probably read certainly more than 100 different definitions of more able. And I think it's a genuinely futile debate. I think context is king with all of this. If you are in certain schools, highly selective, high-performing grammar schools, for example, you would probably argue that all of your students would be in the more able mm-hmm. stream. If you're at Eton, I would probably argue probably very similar, St Paul's, those kinds of schools. So realistically, it's more to do with what is the school doing to look after the most talented students within that school whose needs will not be being met by the regular curriculum mm-hmm. and who therefore are kind of partially excluded. I've worked with many thousands of schools, and I think the key element for me is that provision is the single most important aspect of all of this. It's all very well identifying students, but if that's all you've done, effectively all you're doing is pointing at them. And you need to be doing something in terms of really genuinely approaching their needs. And I would argue that there are several things that we ought to be looking at. There's an idea called liminal learning. And essentially, it's this kind of core idea that if what we should be doing is making sure that all students are working to the very best of what they can achieve at that point in time, and not accepting second best work, for the simple reason that if we are accepting second best work, they could have worked on that to improve it themselves. Any feedback that we give would be useless. So we need to be putting students into that quite awkward space where they are genuinely needing our support and our help. And at that point, any advice we give is genuine guidance and highly useful. Prior to that, I think that we in education waste an awful lot of time in basically supporting, scaffolding away any challenge. And I think that the phrase I would use for that is that we steal the struggle from our students, and they need that struggle, particularly in schools, in order then to be able to survive what is going to happen to them at universities. Universities are not built for supporting students. They're built for a very different purpose. So we really need to make sure that it's schools that are testing out students to the very limits of their ability, because then we can do a huge amount of work to make sure that they're safe and secure with that. Universities don't have the time, and I suspect don't really have the willingness to do that.
So you've published extensively on education for more able students, and that's some of your key advice you have for educators about teaching more able students. What would you say to those who argue that schools shouldn't separate and target specific resources on the more able students?
Well, I'd say they're idiots. I think the kind of key issue for me is that it's an equal opportunities agenda, and it needs to be seen as that. So all students are entitled to be stretched and challenged. So it's not just a small selected group that require that, but the regular curriculum very rarely stretches the students that we're talking about here. And so they also are entitled to that level of stretch and challenge. But also I think we have a responsibility to make sure that the disadvantaged students among that cohort don't disappear underneath the waves unnoticed. And I think that they have been for a very long time. And one of my worries is that very little is done about it. It's a huge squandering of this nation's talent. And it's being, I think it's being ignored.
Right. Is this something in your career you've seen get better much?
It's a very good question. When I first started, it wasn't uncommon to have schools saying things like, well, we don't have any very bright kids in our school. We get our kids from the local estate. That was not an uncommon idea. Wow. So again, even within many schools' heads, there seemed to be this idea that, you know, if you're a pupil premium student, if you have free school meals, then by definition, you aren't going to be smart. And I think that's patronizing nonsense of the worst order, as is the follow-up to that, which is the more able will make it anyway. Right. In my experience over 20 years of teaching, that was certainly not the case. So I think there seems to be an issue, and it's still there in some schools, but I would argue probably now far fewer schools, that it's referred to as the Matthew effect, giving more to those that already have. And again, I find it to be patronizing nonsense, because I've seen too many students bored on an industrial scale. I've interviewed year nine students, many year nine students, in front of head teachers and senior leadership teams, where they have freely admitted that the work they're doing in year nine was work that they had mastered in year five or four sometimes. So secondary schools, I think, are quite guilty of not following on from the kind of fantastic work that's being done in many primary schools. And many of these students don't really shout out loudly enough that they are bored and that they have mastered all this. they tend to get on with it. And I think that's a crying shame.
And presumably those who do maybe get earmarked as just being extremely arrogant or portraying other character vices, the purpose of school is to try to diminish those character vices, right?
Exactly that.
The purpose of school. Okay. So your most recent book, Learning with Leonardo, Unfinished Perfection, focuses on Leonardo da Vinci and explores strategies for improving creativity and innovation. Why have you decided to focus on da Vinci?
There were many reasons for this. One is that, purely coincidentally, in fact, he died 500 years ago to this year,
right.
So 1519. I think the most important one for me was that, although he's recognized as a genius, he earned his genius. When you kind of study Da Vinci, he used to make howling mistakes with his maths. His kind of work on mechanics and his work on were often kind of flawed. Mm-hmm. He earned his genius by throwing himself into as many different disciplines as he could find, often all at once, all at the same time. And often he didn't finish what he wanted to do. But I kind of admire that. So we're not looking at some kind of divine lightning that separates him from the rest of us. So I think, therefore, there is something we can learn from him. Mm-hmm. He had a kind of eclectic brilliance that he kind of dipped his mental brush, if you like, into so many different disciplines: mechanics, anatomy, fossils, motion, light. He had a very free range mind. Mm-hmm. and that intrigued me. He was never interested in consensus. He always focused in on kind of oddities. He foraged into knowledge, but particularly into kind of irregular knowledge. Mm-hmm. He was brilliant at adopting the beginner's perspective. So even as an expert on an issue, it never meant that he finished thinking about it. He threw himself back into it. He threw himself into doing more dissections. I mean, there's a very good example with the classic Mona Lisa smile. The dissections of more than 30 bodies to find out how the smile mechanism works. But also, when he couldn't get hold of human bodies, he got hold of horses to see if horses had similar smile muscles. There's a kind of level of, some would regard it as fanaticism, but I would regard it as genuine wonder, genuine diversity of curiosity. He left the door to the unknown ajar. He's interested in the elusive. He's very interested in the unconscious and its power. He searched for adjacent possibilities all the time. So he became an expert in one field, and that led him into the next field. Mm-hmm. And it gave him really interesting insights into that next field. He never had that kind of arrogance of the expert as the frozen thinker. He learned quite scatteringly. He embraced the chase. He embraced collisions and detours. He was genuinely a fascinating character. And amongst all of this, the kind of artwork is kind of minimal. In fact, kind of what he's known for, mm-hmm. the most famous paintings in the world, the most famous drawings in the world, the most expensive paintings in the world, almost was a kind of a way for him of straddling some of the contradictions that he found in real life. Mm-hmm. So, and other than that, he was also centuries ahead of his time.
Yeah. So I can already see in the wonderful way in which you've explained that some possibilities that could be explored in teaching and learning, such as, you know, promoting certain ways of thinking, like what you call diversive learning or scattered thinking, if you like. What specific lessons do you think we can learn from Da Vinci about teaching and learning?
I think there are seven. When I was kind of researching, what I tried to do was to pull together what I thought were kind of core learning principles that could be used in classrooms. And the ones that I came up with, which I will explain in more detail at another time, probably. I think the first one is this idea of conscious ignorance. Sounds like a contradiction in terms, but actually it's developing a beginner's mind to make sure that you look at all things fresh. Mm-hmm. The second one was the idea of regaining wonder. I wonder if we've kind of kicked out wonder and curiosity from the curriculum. And that's really about the fuel of enthusiasm, mm-hmm. which he had. The third one was around the idea of perfecting attention. He developed this beautiful sensory approach to everything that he did. It wasn't just simply observation, it was analysis, it was interrogation. And that, I think, was very powerful. Mm-hmm. The fourth one was around, this is an unusual phrase, but unnecessary beauty. He developed a dialogue across many, many different disciplines. And if you scour through the 7,000 plus pages of his notebooks, you see things, the most beautiful art. On the front cover of the book, there's a fetus, the drawing of a fetus. Mm-hmm. It is a work of divine beauty, but it wasn't meant for publication. It was never intended for publication. It was intended simply to sort out his own thinking on it. Mm-hmm. It was for him. It was for him. Leonardo wanted to become more Leonardo, and he was trying to put his ideas into this. And next to that picture, you would see cooking recipes, or you would see a note about his soup going cold. That I find quite astonishing. Vitruvian Man, for example, another very, very famous piece of work, resulted simply in him trying to picture a mathematical principle. Mm-hmm. Unnecessary beauty sits right within that.
Oh, so his visualization of the human being within the Vitruvian Man was him just trying to find
working
a way of
out proportions. Yeah.
Wow.
The fifth one was around what I called thinking aside. And this is really to do with kind of metaphorical concepts and metaphorical thinking, pardon me, and metaphorical perspectives. So again, everything about his life was about these kind of collisions of ideas. He wasn't frightened of those collisions. And what he wanted to do, in fact, he believed very strongly that if you threw very differing ideas together, that the mind was incapable of not making connections. Mm-hmm. And new patterns therefore form. Mm-hmm. And those new formations, metaphorically, would advance thinking. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a very interesting device that he came up with. The next one is negative capability, which I've nicked from John Keats. But the idea of allowing yourself to sit in ambiguity, allowing yourself to be uncertain, not having to strive for an answer, but to realize that actually perhaps the two thoughts that are going on in your head both seem true and both might be true, mm-hmm. but you don't necessarily seek this kind of resolution for it. And that I think a lot of that is about what I would refer to as productive frustration. And I think that's been lost. Google allows you to pretty much find everything you want immediately. Mm-hmm. And students are fooled into thinking that there's an answer out there. They're fooled into thinking that Google can come up with that answer in 0.0001 seconds. And they don't realize that actually the frustration of finding things out for yourself mm-hmm. is also a great way of memorizing and remembering that journey. And as a result, if it's coming to you very quickly, it's also forgotten mm-hmm. very, very quickly. And the final one, which is probably the most contentious one of all, is the title of the book, Unfinished Perfection. And I refer to it as sustained irresolution. He never wanted to finish anything. When he died, he still had many of his artworks around him. He was commissioned to do the Mona Lisa 16 years before and still had never delivered it. He was working on Jerome in the Wilderness and still working on the neck muscles of Jerome through his dissections. He knew he hadn't got it right. Mm-hmm. And he refused to freeze the evolution of his thinking. Mm-hmm. And so he was continually going back to it. It's not saying that perfection, he was still wanting the chance of perfection, but he recognized that it was highly unlikely that he would ever come up with that. And I like that humility. And I think that's key.
Yes. Well, that's absolutely fascinating. I mean, one thing that strikes me particularly from what you said there is the possible pertinence of Leonard's approach to learning in the 21st century, when there's so much information and we're faced with such a constant stream of information. Do you think that, you know, in 2019 there is more of a place for the kind of learning of what you call scattered learning or diversive thinking, that it has a more important role now than perhaps it did 50 years ago, given the way in which we're confronted with so much information now?
I think it does. And I think the refusal to accept what you are given unless you test it for yourself, I think, is also a key element there. And one of the kind of fears that I have now is that students aren't discriminating. They are being given information and they are accepting that information too readily. And so that the kind of power of discrimination that certainly Leonardo had, but I think we need to be encouraging in our students. I think it's probably one of the most important skills that they will have.
Encouraging critical thinking then? Do
you mean? Critical thinking, I think, is a key part of that.
Being part and parcel with the process also of scattered thinking. So
yeah. But also this idea of thinking aside, not accepting what it is you are offered.
Yeah.
And making sure that you are thinking about it for yourself. So perfecting attention, your interrogation is key.
Thank you. Okay, well, I could keep talking to you about Da Vinci and your lessons for learning all day, but we should also talk about your other work, of which there is a great deal. Your 2017 book, World Class, outlined what you call the 10 biggest challenges facing schools today. Of those challenges, is there any one of them that you think is the greatest challenge facing schools today, and how should we address it?
This is going to be deeply unpopular. My fear, my concern is that there is a lack of teacher expertise at the very top end. And even more unpopular, that I have seen this across many, many schools that I've worked with, state schools in particular. Perhaps you have a physics teacher teaching you in your upper sixth, who isn't actually trained as a physics teacher. Mm-hmm. It's a mathematician who's working as a physics teacher, doing his very best or her very best to kind of make sure that the students are challenged. But it strikes me as a very isolated and lonely place to be. In a state school, you may have one physics teacher in three or four or five different schools in a consortium. Mm-hmm. In many independent schools, for example, you might have a physics department of 10 or 12 or 15, all of whom are talking to one another about how they're teaching to that very top end, all of whom are making sure that they are up to date with what is happening in their field and the best ways of teaching that. And so my fear is that state school students are not being given the kind of challenge that they need to at that very top end. And therefore, I don't see that it's likely that the very top grades which they require to get into world-class universities will necessarily be part of that. So I think we need more kind of intellectual heft mm-hmm. in the profession. I think we need to make sure that teachers see education as slightly more risk-taking, freewheeling, demanding. All of this is based on a very simple principle, which is that you can't teach what you don't know. And I think I would probably, in order to do something about it, reboot teacher training. Mm-hmm. I'd reboot those colleges, I'd cut the numbers, I'd require far more selection and rigour. I would improve that baseline professional standard. And I think we need to improve the prestige of the teaching force as well. Otherwise, I think what we'll find is that students too easily will lower their sights, lose commitment, lose passion, acquiesce to spoon feeding, acquiesce to easy success, and that the students themselves will be under-challenged. And we're creating a kind of helplessness there as well in the classroom.
Okay, so pursuing more your kind of practical advice then on how that would work in practice with reforming teacher colleges and so on. So maybe let's elaborate a little more on that, because that's very interesting and I'm sure it'll be of great interest to listeners. You would embed within teacher training, say, more detailed courses within the specific area they're studying, and you also said make them more selective, but at the same time create maybe a culture shift in what it means to be a teacher and how much it's respected as a profession, so there's not a dearth of teachers as a consequence of that, because that would be the immediate objection. Yes. Right?
There are still far too little teaching about subject-specific expertise, mm-hmm. and too much generic, general talking about ideas of differentiation or whatever the kind of flavour of the month is at that particular time. Mm-hmm. And I've interviewed many hundreds of students at teacher training colleges where they've been given literally zero training on anything to do with more able education, for example. But the key element, I still believe, is the subject specific. And it's all too easy as a teacher to allow your expertise to become dated. Mm-hmm. But also, I think teacher training colleges need to look far more specifically at what is now being required by the exam boards for the very top grades. And frankly, they're not doing that.
Right. So built into teacher training would be a greater emphasis on enriching one's subject-specific knowledge, rather than most of it being placed upon, say, the kind of general teaching strategies you might learn, such as how to differentiate in a classroom, teaching methodologies, and so on and so forth. Okay, thank you. Changing subject, what are you currently working on?
Three main things. I'm writing a book at the moment with Dr. Martin Stephen, who was ex-head of St. Paul's. And we're working on the kind of rather overheated issue of academic selection. Mm-hmm. And when we worked on our previous book, what people found quite astonishing was that someone from a very independent school background, he taught at Manchester, he was head teacher of Manchester Grammar and Perse, we frankly didn't disagree on a single issue, or even a semicolon throughout the writing of the book. So we're hoping that actually we'll look at this idea of selection, we'll interview lots of teachers around this kind of concept. There's a lot of, dare I say it, there's a lot of hypocrisy around the idea of intelligence. And it's almost an embarrassment for some teachers to talk about. And I think we need to get away from that. Mm-hmm. I think we need to kind of look at what we need to be doing for smart students. Mm-hmm. Second book I'm doing is around the idea of cultural capital and cultural identity. My fears around the kind of one-downmanship that's happening in terms of some of those issues. And looking at, again, what the implications may be within schools and what we can do. And the third project I'm working on is a very specific one across Africa. I'm working with the Association for Independent Schools across Africa. I've been working with them for a few years now, and we've developed models and ideas for networking of schools across Africa, online training modules. Mm. So continuing on with that work, it's hugely rewarding. The level of need is enormous, but the level of commitment is quite wonderful. Mm. And so I'm also a trustee of two charities over there as well, in Kenya and so we've been working with a lot of slum students as well to try and improve their chances in life. So it's an area that I'm kind of interested in and want to continue with.
Is this across, which areas of Africa is this across?
The last area that we looked and kind of worked in was Senegal. We're looking now, ASA works across all of Africa, mm-hmm. pardon me. And so when we were in Senegal, educators were coming in from Madagascar, educators were coming in from Nigeria, they were coming in from Kenya, they were coming in from many, many different areas around Africa. So what we're trying to do is establish how we can develop an infrastructure to keep those teachers in contact with one another, mm-hmm. but also focusing in on kind of key ideas, and how those can be shared. considering many, many of those schools don't have internet access, for example, or maybe internet access once every 2 or 3 weeks, that can be quite challenging.
Yeah.
You also have the issue of, I mean, one of the schools that I've been working with in Rwanda had Ebola right on the kind of frontier. So schools being closed down because of issues like that. So there's a lot of challenge there.
Mm-hmm.
But the key thing is that the enthusiasm of the teachers that we've met and we've worked with, I think will drive forward huge change.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the word intelligence a moment ago. How would you define intelligence?
I wouldn't.
I think it's a very elusive concept. Right? So
I wouldn't. I think it would be a very foolish thing to do. I think it's been fairly well debunked as a kind of myth that there are kind of multiple intelligences and the kind of whole Gardner idea. I do believe that there is, that IQ tests have a place. And all the research tends to suggest that there is certainly a kind of general intelligence, and that that factor can be quite predictive of many, many interesting areas in students' life. However, having said all of that, I do not believe that that is the, getting back almost to your first question about what is more able, I don't think that the kind of standardized tests are the kind of the way forward. I think professional judgment of teachers is far more significant.
Right.
I would agree with kind of peer nomination. I would agree with students' own nominations. I think that there's a huge amount that can be added to the kind of mix, if you like, across the school.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe in a kind of revolving door model of identification, so that it used to be that we defined what we wanted to see. More able students look like this, and those kind of characteristics were kind of written up, and then we identified the students according to those characteristics and provided for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's far more sensible to provide in the first place, and students often then will self-identify. They become intrigued by things. They very difficult to know, for example, if you're a highly talented film editor.
Mm-hmm.
If no one has ever given you any opportunities to edit movies and to use top-class equipment. So sometimes the provision itself is a means of identification.
Mm-hmm.
And once those students have self-identified, then more provision around that basis. And I think schools should be looking at that kind of idea that more able education is about a kind of talent profile, if you like, mm-hmm. of the school, and that it's constantly shifting and changing.
So kind of a first step then is to be providing the opportunities to explore
precisely
areas where one might have the potential for something that they haven't yet realised.
Yeah.
Okay. So at the centre in here, the Eaton Centre for Innovation, Research and Learning, we focus on research and education. What do you think are the most important areas where more research and education is needed?
I would almost, I mean, the issues around selection are key, and I've kind of raised those before. I think a lot of work needs to be done around that. But I would actually argue that the thing that the system, the kind of commonwealth, if you like, of education is missing out on is partnership.
Partnership.
The impact of partnership. I've run probably about 10 independent state school partnerships.
Mm-hmm.
Some for many, many years. And I have been astonished by the learning that takes place within those partnerships. They're often subject-specific partnerships. You get a group of physics teachers together and ask them what challenges they're facing and what they can do about it. And you give them the kind of venue and the opportunity to kind of talk to one another, to come up, to create resources together, to deliver resources in one another's school. The learning is both ways. And I think it's very, very powerful. And what's happening at the moment, it seems to me, is that those kind of inter-school partnerships, many of which are happening and many of which are quite superb, aren't getting enough publicity, they're not getting enough press. Maybe we're talking about them in the wrong way. I think there's very poor outreach at the moment. But I'm a huge advocate of them. And I think that the improving practice, the power of those, the potential of those, is absolutely key. And one of my worries here is that there's a lack of dialogue, and probably that there is, in many areas, kind of mutual suspicion. And every single partnership that I've worked on has relied on the fact that state schools have equally as much to offer in terms of the practice that's going on within teaching and learning as independent schools. So it needs to be seen as a kind of more equitable relationship. But I just haven't seen the kind of research being done that really focuses in on the impact of some of these.
Right, so so a very worthwhile area to explore would be the impact of existing independent state school partnerships, what they're doing well, where they could improve. You think that would be a really good area?
I think that's a critical one. And I know that it's something that many, many schools are focusing on at the moment. I know Eton is focusing on it particularly, but I know that I just finished working for a partnership that started with a group of South East London schools. There are many schools now seeking mutual support. And one of the dangers, in the same way that observation and professional dialogue was kind of damaged by, to a great extent, by Ofsted.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a huge amount that these kind of partnerships can offer once the suspicion has been kind of knocked out of the way.
Right.
And once the kind of the planning has been put into place, and once it's very clear what the kind of principles of these partnerships should be, and of course the impact of them, and it's very useful to see that, you know, if there's some research being done on this, some sharing of the kind of best work, and some of the great innovative ideas that are happening, and then set these up not as kind of patronizing, you know, independent schools maintaining their charitable status through, you know, helping the local schools,
mm-hmm.
but more as a kind of an idea of, we're all physics teachers, we're all biology teachers, we're all MFL teachers, we are all facing similar issues, similar problems, similar exam boards. What is it that we can do as a group to kind of better for our students the opportunities that are out there?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a kind of coherence that needs to come in terms of these partnerships. And I think it's a very, very significant area for the entire educational commonwealth.
Right, so it's not merely about exchanging good practice or sharing resources, but paramount to all this is kind of an initial first step of shaping a healthy relationship between independent and state schools in the first place. You think there's maybe a little bit of hostility between, if we can generalise in quite a significant degree, there's a bit of hostility between those in the independent state sector, or that such that it's hampering the ability to get a good...
I think it's extremely difficult a lot of the time to even understand what's going on in the different sector. And that, I think, breeds some of that suspicion.
Mm-hmm.
I worked on a partnership with maybe 7 or 8 independent schools across London.
Mm-hmm.
And we pulled together a whole number of state schools that had extremely good practice within modern foreign languages, as a good example. The minute we got all of these teachers together, the one thing they focused on
mm-hmm.
was that they were effectively, not to kind of paraphrase them too much, boring some of their students, some of their most able students, to within an inch of their life. And that some of the most able linguists weren't then continuing on into year 10 or 11 or into the sixth form,
mm-hmm.
certainly not going on to study it at the university. And that was a general problem across many of these schools. So it wasn't a state school problem or an independent school problem, it was a combined issue.
Right.
So what we focused on was, what provision could we make? What resources could we develop? How could we make the subject meet the needs of those students? We focused on the idea of film as a high challenge resource, and it kind of enabled very authentic language. It focused in on the importance of the culture, and rather than kind of vocab
yeah.
and grammar. And for more able kids, that was the stuff that they were interested in.
Right.
And they probably had already grasped the concepts of grammar and vocab quite early on. And so they were being dragged down a similar kind of course year after year after
mm-hmm.
year. And therefore, unsurprisingly, were choosing different subjects.
I see.
So the demands at GCSE were too low. Schools were meeting those kind of levels of demand, and these more able students were being bored, and they were therefore not going to continue on to study at A level. So this idea of a shared common problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen this with physics teachers, I've seen this with chemistry teachers, with English teachers, with maths teachers. And that, it seems to me, a kind of healthy way to start pulling partnerships together rather than quite nebulous concept of working with other schools, where it tends to be things like, you know, we'll lend you our playing field for a couple of days, or you can use our swimming pool, or, you know, we can lend you a couple of physics teachers. I'm not undermining those or demeaning those, but that's not what a partnership is.
Yes, yeah, I see what you mean. And when I used the word hostility in my question to try and figure out exactly what you meant, suspicion was the word you used, so that's a better word to go for.
I think it is, yes. And I think it's inevitable, because if the dialogue isn't there, and frankly, if political parties are starting to make this a kind of hot area,
mm-hmm.
then we aren't going to get sensible dialogue coming from anywhere apart from within our own schools.
Do you think it's good that political parties are making this a hot area?
No, absolutely not. I think it's a ridiculous thing to do. And I think it's enormously unhelpful.
Well, that seems a fitting way to finish the interview. Thank you very much, Ian Warwick, for joining us today and for a fascinating discussion about your work and about education. Thank you very much for listening to the Eton Centre for Innovation in Research and Learning podcast. If you're interested in Ian's work, there's also a podcast on a talk he's giving this evening on his most recent book, Learning with Leonardo, Unfinished Perfection. You can also access that on our podcast. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.
Goodbye.